Did you have some like real ones when you were up here?
I had with Renee. I had one at the Hotel Nelligan, whatever you call it, restaurant. And it was good. I mean, it was not really that
great. Right?
Yeah. It wasn't that different than a New York bagel, as much as I'll give you guys shit about it publicly. It really wasn't that bad. Yeah. That was a terrible way of phrasing it. What I mean to say is it wasn't as different as I had expected. And thus, since it was very similar to what I'm used to, I quite liked it.
So the thing to me is not – I mean, it's fun to just fight about bagels.
Right.
Basically, there's people who actually have quality bagels, like New York or Montreal or whatever. Sure. And then there's the bullshit that you get everywhere else.
The hotel bagels.
like the perfectly formed, exactly round, like dry and just awful. Oh, God.
Dempster's bagels.
Yeah. That's not a bagel. I'm sorry. No, a bagel is fucked up because somebody made it with love.
It's a tire-shaped bread pot.
Just like people.
Right?
So, yeah, so you're the least favorite person on the Accidental Tech Podcast.
Well, slow down. I don't know if I'm the least I'm the least well known.
Well, okay. Let me rephrase that. I like you the least.
You're the best known .NET programmer on ATP.
That is true. I do have that going for me.
Yeah, we'll exciting. Eventually get to, you know, what you may or may not be competent at.
We'll find out.
I'm just set on being a jerk to you. I'm sorry. Just you're gonna have to run with it. Yeah. Well, you're so long suffering and good natured that it. You know. So, sort of the joke question is, who the hell is Casey Liss? And this could be the answer to that. How'd you get into programming? Like, how did you start out?
Right. So. I'm actually speaking at CocoConf in Washington, D.C. in a little under a month. Holy God, I really should get on the ball with my presentation. Well, anyways, what I'm hoping to talk about is kind of my origin story and how my origin story is actually very unremarkable and could be anyone's origin story. And so I'll give you the short version of it. When I was growing up, I always kind of was around computers. My dad works for IBM as in various roles, but he comes from an accounting background. And so he wasn't like a developer or anything like that. But he's always been fairly computer literate and savvy. And so I remember way back when he had some sort of device that he would stick the phone handset on upside down and that had to happen, you know, so it was one of those old school modems with like the cups for the headset on the regular telephone. That's and weird. And
like,
so anyway,
war games.
Right. And exactly like war games. And so so
well, he's an accountant and he works at IBM. So, you know, the rock and roll is definitely in his bones.
Well, actually, apparently my mom, when she first met him, this was before IBM, when he was an auditor, he apparently had the hots for my mom. This is a terrible story, but I'm committed now. He had the hots for my mom. My mom, this is like in 75.
Yeah, I've
like
got my the mom, hots for your mom too.
thanks, guy. Zing. I bet she would like you too. Anyways, so she saw him and he had like short hair. And again, this is like 75. So he's, oh God, he's so... I forget what the term was then, like dweeby or whatever. Well, so come find out, she's looking out the window one day just by happenstance, and he comes in like a Triumph sports car and does like a 360 into his parking spot. And suddenly my mom's like, oh, well, apparently he's not so dweeby. Well, anyways, so to come back to the point that I was trying to get to, and then I derailed myself seven times, was that I was always around computers. And eventually my dad gave me like an old 8088 PC, like one of the original PCs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And he put it in my room because at this point, like a 386 was modern or something like that. And so he put it in my room and I would fiddle with it. And I would ask him, hey, Dad, how do you do this? Or, hey, Dad, how do you do that? And this is all in DOS. And eventually, and he's a wonderful father, a wonderful man, but not the most patient human in the world. And eventually he said to me, just fucking read the book. And he hands me the DOS 3.3 manual. And and so sure enough,
actually, I remember that one.
Yeah.
The IBM one too. Like, yep. Not the Microsoft one. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And
was it ring bound? It might've been ring bound.
So there's, it's funny you ask that because I just bought one for pure nostalgic sake for like 10 bucks, 15 bucks from somewhere in Boston. And there was a short, like human version that was kind of like spiral bound sort of. Yeah. And then there's the big fat ass version that you're supposed to put in like a 3-ring binder for the complete nerds. Right, right. And so I read the kind of spiral bound one. And after that, I started writing like batch scripts to automate, you know, starting different games. And then, you know, fast forward not too long and it's like 486 time. And in DOS, you needed to worry about like conventional memory and how much conventional memory you had available.
Expanded memory.
Yes. Exactly.
Two different things.
Yep. Two different things.
Because the world has to burn to the core. Because why would you do that? But anyway.
It was so bad. It was so bad. Yeah. But I would write like these bitchin' autoexec bat like menu system.
config.sys.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you couldn't do a lot with the config sys, but you could write a really awesome autoexec bat system. So I would have like this menuing system where I would say, I want to go into games and then I want to go into this game and it would or would not turn on the mouse drive.
You could actually put like there was like a DOS commands that you could throw up like a menu. It was all textual based, right?
Yep. Exactly. And it was like ASCII art for the borders and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I remember thinking I was really cool. Because I made my.
Well, you know what was the coolest?
The
double line borders.
That's what I did.
Of course you did.
Same here.
Because the single line borders is like, just one line.
That's pedestrian.
Double line. Come on.
Exactly. And so I wrote this like crazy system. And I remember thinking I was extremely cool because I figured out how to turn the background red and the text yellow, because apparently when you're 12 or whatever I was, that is cool.
Yeah.
So.
By the way, white on blue is the way to go.
Ah, see, good to know.
It's the only acceptable thing. Although green could also be a good background with white.
You know, the funny thing is you're probably trolling with like Montreal's colors and I wouldn't even know it.
I'm actually not. I wish it had. Although white and blue would probably, yeah.
Exactly. You don't want like a big red maple leaf or whatever.
Well, red is just right in your face, you know. Anyway, whatever.
Right. So
we have to spend the whole show talking about this.
Exactly. So after that led to like QBasic programming. And then that led to Visual Basic programming, and then that led eventually to college. Or do you guys call college or university up there?
It's called CGEP in Quebec. Don't even ask.
It's not even Canada. Canada doesn't understand our system, so don't bother. It's
fair enough. All right, so I went to college. I went to school at Virginia Tech and majored in computer engineering, and so there I learned C++. And just a little bit of C#. And my first job was as a C++ developer writing bingo-based slot machines, which was a wild ride, to say the least.
So what you like about it? What captured you at that early age? Was it really just like, I want to play my game? But because you clearly crafted the menu to get you into the game.
Yes. And this was back when I really cared about gaming, which I don't really anymore. But you're absolutely right. It was a means to an end to get into the game. And I think I have that common quality amongst all developers, which is that I hate to repeat myself, which in turn is a very nice way of saying I'm lazy as hell. And so I didn't want to have to worry about, which series of commands do I need to execute on the command prompt in order to get the exact minimum amount of drivers I needed in order to run this game, with enough conventional memory to actually run it. And so being able to do that repeatedly without having to worry about it, I think, is what really turned me on.
That makes sense. Do you have a favorite game at the time?
Oh, goodness. During that era, God, that was so long ago. I barely remember. I remember liking Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, even though I didn't understand it because I was too young. I remember liking Wolfenstein 3D.
Right.
And of course, I went through like Doom and Quake and all that. I think it was a little bit after this time frame, but I loved the hell out of Descent, the original Descent.
Yes. Yeah.
And my dad bought this like really awesome Thrustmaster joystick where you would plug the keyboard into the joystick and then plug the joystick into the PC.
Oh,
and so the joystick could, you know, it basically issue keyboard commands. And for Descent, that was amazing because you could use like the various switches on the joystick to, you know, go forward and back and so on and so forth. Without
right. If people don't know, Descent is a 6 degree of freedom 3D video game where you play like a fighter, but you can move up, down, left, right,
forward, like, back,
everywhere. Yeah, forward, back. It's kind of bananas and spin. It's pretty nuts. Like, it's the kind of thing where a custom joystick may actually help you out a lot.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that was kind of my upbringing. And then when I got to school, when I got to college, that was around the time that Half-Life was big and Counter-Strike? I can't remember now. There was some mod, I think it was Counter-Strike, that was really popular. And actually, one of the guys who wrote it went to tech a few years before I did. And so I played a lot of Counter-Strike when I was in college, but I missed like all the MMOs. This is when MMOs started. It's like EverQuest was big at the time. Mm-hmm. And I dodged all that. Never really got interested in that.
I was not a big MMO guy either. Played a little bit of World of Warcraft.
Yeah, I played like, I don't know. I think I got a free account on World of Warcraft just to see what my crazy friends were so excited about. And I played it for like a week and felt like it was work. And then I never looked back.
I actually had a gig in the States and, this is going to get me arrested, but in Houston. And the thing that I had to tell the guys going in, like the reason that I could get my temporary SSN was that I was an expert on MMOs, which I was not. But it turned out the guy at the border who questioned me for 20 minutes was a huge EverQuest fan.
Oh, great.
And I'm like, I just made shit up. Like, I just literally.
And apparently just, that worked.
In case you, please don't block me from going to the States. It's my livelihood. But I'm sorry.
You did what you needed to do to survive.
I did have an essential function at the company at the time. I just. It
making
wasn't,
MMOs was
it
not
wasn't it. One you could explain to people, you know. So, MMO. Anyway. Yeah.
How about that?
And he's, you know, he wants to know what shard I'm on. I'm like, I don't even know where to start.
You could have just gobbledygooked him and hit the driving pedal.
No, he couldn't because he was gobbledygooking me. That was the thing. Like, there was all these words. I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. And I'm the expert in the field. So, sorry.
Games of the devil.
That's right. You should have been like, I'm a religious expert on it.
Exactly. It was awful. Anyway.
Oh, goodness.
I'll be in prison for like 30 years. So Virginia Tech, how'd that go for you?
Terribly. I mean, I love my alma mater. I'm very glad I went there. I wouldn't have gone anywhere else in the world, but I was a terrible student, just an abysmally bad student. My priorities were just all over the place. And when I was in high school, I went to high school in a small town in Connecticut, and not to be a complete tool, but I didn't have to try very hard and I got pretty good grades. And so then I majored in computer engineering, which was a very different setup than computer science, at least at Tech anyway. And it was extraordinarily difficult. And I never really learned how to study growing up. And I don't mean that to toot my own horn, because I'll tell you in the next breath that I almost flunked out of Tech pretty much for 4 straight years. But I never really knew how to study. And I really wanted to quit engineering with all of my being, but something in me knew that I would regret it. And it was partially influenced by my dad saying, you know, hey, I went to school for engineering for a year, and then he ended up dropping out and going back to school later. And he said, you know, I regret that to this day. And I don't know, my dad usually isn't very forceful about a lot. And when he is, I tend to pay attention, and I'm very glad I did in this case, because I did barely squeak by with a computer engineering degree. And luckily, when I went to that first job writing slot machines, they didn't really care to ask for a transcript. And I mean, I did graduate, don't get me wrong, but it was by the skin of my teeth. So
so what's the difference between computer engineering and computer science?
So at Tech anyway, computer science was just straight software development, and you got very little in the way of hardware, whereas computer engineering was kind of half electrical engineering and half computer science. So we did as much electrical engineering, like we did DC electrical engineering. We got into the very basics of AC electrical engineering, which was unbelievably difficult. And I forget the name of the course, but it doesn't matter. And then we did a plenty of computer science as well, almost as much computer science as a computer science major. So it was a little bit of both. And so in summary, a computer engineer in theory should be able to go all the way from a high level language like C# all the way down to logic gates within the CPU. And of course, I haven't thought about that in 15 or 10 years or whatever.
Yeah. But in theory, we can put you in a cave in Afghanistan with a box of you can come out with Iron Man, right?
Yeah, exactly. I am easily as smart as Tony Stark. Easily.
I just, that's it. That's the show.
And
just,
we're done.
We made an Iron Man joke. We're done.
Yep, it's been great talking to you guys.
So, well, you know, how were the slot machines? Like, what was the, was that just, it seems like an odd job.
It was a very odd job. So what happened was I graduated and, you know, because I'd never really done an internship and because my grades were really crummy, I didn't have anything lined up when I graduated. And so I moved back in with mom and dad and was just kind of looking around for a while. And then very randomly, I got an email from a classmate that I kind of knew in passing who was working in Charlottesville, Virginia. And it's important to realize that Virginia Tech, and it was not in Charlottesville. It was in a different part of Virginia called Blacksburg. And in Charlottesville is our big rivals, the University of Virginia. And by almost any measure, the University of Virginia is a considerably better school, although I would argue that Virginia Tech's engineering program is actually quite a bit better. Well, anyway, so he's in Charlottesville and he says, hey, I've...
Isn't Charlottesville like the sort of population center in Virginia?
Well, so now we're going to go on a really big tangent. I'll try to keep it quick. Virginia's kind of...
As a guy from Montreal, Quebec, I know a lot about Virginia and its population distribution.
So. Right. So basically, there's three states in Virginia. There's Northern Virginia, which is basically just D.C. extended. Then there's Central Virginia, which is where Richmond is, which is where I am now, and Charlottesville. And Central Virginia is where I would argue you transition from the north to the south within the United States. And then Southern Virginia, which is where Virginia Tech is all, you know, very, very rural and very, very, I don't know what the kind word for redneck is, so I'll just say redneck. It's country. It's very country. There you go. We'll edit that out.
it's an interesting state.
It is. And so this guy emails.
So anyway, you're in Charlottesville.
Yeah. Right. So the guy emails me and says, hey, I'm going to pass resumes around in Charlottesville to a few local companies. You want me to send yours around? I said, hell yeah. And so he passes it to this small company called Video Gaming Technologies. And I went down.
What a great name.
For you especially, this should be.
Video Gaming Technologies. Perfect.
Yep. And so what they did was they wrote slot machines that were bingo based. And the reason they were bingo based was in Oklahoma, there were Indian gaming casinos, but you couldn't play traditional games of skill, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. You could only play games of chance. Yeah. And so what these slot machines were, where you were really playing bingo, and there was a little like 3x3 LCD or something like that, that would show your bingo board. And you would be playing bingo. And depending on how your bingo card went, we would spin the reels deliberately to show an equivalent win or loss. So if you win 1,000 points or whatever in bingo, we'll do the three cherries or whatever the case may be to represent 1,000 points on the reels. So if you didn't know any better, it looks like you're playing a slot machine, but in reality, you're playing bingo. So I went and interviewed with them and they gave me a job, and it was me and one other guy that I graduated with. And the team was between 15 and 20 people. And that was writing C++ in DOS with the Wacom compiler.
Yeah.
And
the good one. Wacom is great. DOS 4GW, baby.
Oh, yeah. And so it was very, very, very weird. And it was funny being such a Doom fan as a kid. And then fast forward to my real life job, which was barely a job because, you know, we wore shorts and flip flops and all the guys were ex-EA guys. But I get to my job and I'm working with unpacking WAD files. It was because I guess the technology was either open source or just kind of figured out or whatever.
Yeah, I think they'd opened it. And WAD wasn't that kind of, so just for the listeners, WAD was the sort of resource file format used by Doom, I believe.
Right.
I think Quakey did something else.
All the data or something like that. And so,
what does it stand for?
Where's all the data, I believe.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Yep. And so it was kind of like a zip file without actually being a zip file. And so it was just weird that here's something that I knew so intimately from a consumer level when I was gaming in Doom. Right. Now I had to know at a developer professional level when I was writing games in my job. But, you know, let me tell you, the best way to transition from programming in your, you know, t-shirt and shorts with your friends working on a project at school is programming in t-shirt and shorts with your coworkers, and debugging, and I'm doing air quotes, is playing a slot machine. Yeah, it was really a fairly easy transition, to say the least.
Are you a gambler?
Not really. I've been to Vegas once. I've been to one of the casinos in Connecticut called Mohegan Sun a handful of times. I'm not a big gambler, never played a lottery, but I mean, I knew barely enough that I sort of understood what the hell was going on.
But so if you see one of these machines, is that, do you just distrust them? Are you like, it's...
No, no, not at all. And it's funny because especially at the time when I said, oh, I work on slot machines, what's the secret? Right. It didn't matter who I was talking to, family, friend, didn't matter. What's the secret? Well, to be honest, there isn't one. Or if there is, damned if I know what it is.
Right.
And even if I did know, you'd have to go all the way to freaking Oklahoma to go try it anyway. So, which suffice to say is nowhere near Virginia, in case any of our listeners don't know. So, I don't know. One of these days, I feel like I need to. One of these days, I feel like I need to invite myself along with, you know, Gruber, etc., to a trip to Vegas. But I feel like I would survive 8 hours, and then I'd have to fly myself home because I'd be near dead.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you need to say anything else. That pretty much sums it.
Just that's the way it works. Bankrupt and dead. That's the two ways you leave. So how long did that gig last? You're doing C++, you're writing Games of Chance.
Yep.
And then what?
Yeah, and so it was very important because I learned how to debug the manly way, which is to say without a debugger.
Right.
But that lasted somewhere between a year and a half and 2 years, and then I moved on.
Well, you had some kind of printf output, right?
At least. Yeah, absolutely right. And then I can't remember how I did it, but I remember writing this fairly cool like debugging setup where you could like create a watch on a variable, and the whole game was based on a time, like a run loop, basically. It was our own custom run loop. And so it would add itself to the run loop and see if this variable's value had changed, and then like pop up a little message, like a printf basically saying, oh, the variable changed, and so on and so forth. I actually was pretty proud of that. But
wait, we should get into this a bit because you're writing this game in DOS.
Mm-hmm.
And if the listeners don't know, you don't get to write games in DOS without writing the entire operating system stack effectively.
Basically, yeah.
You need to be able to render. So you literally get a pointer to the screen. You set the screen in a certain mode. You get a pointer to it, and then, you know, you're up. Like,
yeah, pretty much.
Copy the bitmap to the memory area, and you're done, kind of thing. So you had a – this is not a trivial, like, well, I'm just going to write a slot machine in iOS.
Right.
You're
on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was wild. And, you know, by the time I got there, it was a relatively mature product. But, I mean, we had to deal with some interesting stuff. Like, we had TCPIP in there. And I don't – there was some TCPIP stack, which if you mentioned it, I'd probably remember it. It doesn't matter. But suffice to say –
this is before WinSock. Like,
exactly.
Well, I don't know if it's before, but you can't use WinSock. I just want to drive this point home in that you couldn't open a network port without writing the entire network driver yourself.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, like I said, there was some third-party add-on to DOS. So just to put things in perspective, you know, in order to do TCPIP networking, you had to add to the operating system. That's how rudimentary it was. Right. And it was pretty wild. And like I was starting to say, it was mature enough that I didn't have to worry about a lot of the low-level stuff. But nevertheless, I mean, everything was done by hand.
Is not a trivial code base.
That
you might expect. It's like, well, a slot machine, I could do that on my iPhone in an afternoon. That's not the case.
This is Frontier with an outhouse and no train.
Pretty much. It's very true. And I mean, it was a lot of work. I feel like the organization at that time was relatively dysfunctional. But nevertheless, I learned probably more in that year and a half to 2 years than I did in four years at my university. And again,
That's the bit I wanted to actually drive home, is that you must have learned a crap load of stuff just because of how complicated and how intricate this is. It sounds like a trivial thing to do. It's not at the time, given what you were working on.
Right. And I learned everything, basically. I learned how to write code like an adult.
Right.
I learned source control. I'd never used source control before. It was never taught in school. We never had like a software engineering course. We had, you know, basic development. Then we had advanced development. We had like operating systems where you would kind of write your own shell and Unix and stuff like that. But I never did, you know, normal, here's how you run a software project. So I never used version control before. It was wild. Right. We used Perforce and I'd never touched anything. I hadn't touched CVS, I hadn't touched a Subversion, never touched anything. So I had to learn what source control was. It was trial by fire, but I'm extremely thankful for it because I learned an
unbelievable. My first gig, I learned the exact same. Well, we didn't even have source control. What we did was, and I don't know, it sounds like maybe this is 3, 4, maybe 5 years before what you were doing. Tools existed, but for whatever reason, the first lead programmer I had didn't like them. And so we would do integration by going on the network and copying over all the files.
Oh.
Opening the files in, not Xcode, what's it called? Source. What's the Microsoft one called?
SourceSafe?
No. That's version control.
Visual Studio.
Visual Studio, yeah. So we'd open them both up and we would tab between them. Like, I think you could hit control tab to like jump between two open windows, if they were tabs, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. So you had tab. Everything looks the same. Okay. Page down in the other one. Tab, until they didn't look the same, until visually, like you clue into a change. And then copy and paste the thing, and then keep going. It was bananas. It is.
I can't imagine.
So incredibly primitive. I mean, every now and then, you see Git screws up or I just want to throw source control against the wall. But what I actually started with, wow. It's unbelievable.
Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. And it was wild. And this was also to set the stage. I mean, this was 2004. So, I mean, DOS was barely a thing at this point. And, yep. Everyone was doing work in Windows. Our competitors were doing work in Windows. So we had a lot of technical debt, a lot of technical debt. But it was a fairly lean organization, so we didn't really have the ability to just kind of reinvent the wheel. And again, I learned a tremendous amount, and I'm extremely thankful for it. And it was as much as I joke, it was a really great transition from being a child to being an adult, in that I didn't have to get dressed up in some fancy suit, so to speak, in order to go to work. I rolled into work the same way I rolled into class, and it was really great.
So why'd you leave?
So I left because all the guys I was working with, and it was almost exclusively men, that was why. No, because all of them were folks that basically, I don't know how to say this delicately, but they basically didn't have families and really didn't have a life outside work. And it's not because they weren't good people. They were excellent people, both on a professional and personal level. But a lot of them didn't understand that some of us don't want to work 112 hours a week. And that was partially me probably being a little bit on the entitled side and partially them just being in a different kind of social atmosphere. And that bled into work and that became challenging.
I disagree with you thinking that that's you being on the entitled side.
No, I appreciate it. I mean, it's hard.
Because in this industry, it's common where it's like, well, you got to work like 180 hours a week. It's, mm-hmm. No, it's you don't. You shouldn't have to.
Right. I agree. And a good friend of mine, Jamie Pinkham, he had said to me once a few years back, and I think he's right, that if you're working more than roughly 40 hours a week on a regular basis, something is just fundamentally wrong. And it may be with you. It may be with management. It may be with your team lead. It may be with any number of things. But if you have to put in more than about 40 hours a week to get your work done, something's broken. And I think he's right.
Yeah, I think so too.
So left there and I decided, you know what, instead of this small, easygoing shop where I can roll in shorts and sandals, I'm going to go ahead and go to Northrop Grumman. so that's what I did.
Let's go kill people.
Right. And it's funny you say that because my joke at the time was that,
Top Gun and you wanted to change.
Yeah, that's it. I was Maverick before Mavericks. No, not really.
Okay.
I joked that, I've handled the sin or vice, whatever it is, of gambling. Now I'm handling death. And so at the time, I pretty much assumed that my next job was going to be something porn related just so I could cover all my bases.
You're going horseman to horseman, basically.
Right. Exactly right. And so I went and worked for a subsidiary of Northrop Grumman called Sperry Marine, which has kind of since been completely enveloped by the Borg. And
wait,
they do.
Wait, why do I know that name?
I don't know. But if you did, it's because they did the navigation systems or do the navigation systems for pretty much every ship in the U.S. Navy, which I know doesn't mean a lot to you two, but
no,
but
I had friends. I had friends in the Canadian Navy, and I know a lot of it.
Well, and that's
I'm
what
a nerd,
I was
so it's quite possible that anyway. Yeah.
I think they sold, if not to the Navy, to the Canadian Coast Guard, I believe.
Yeah, I totally believe that. Yeah. I think the radar systems.
Yes, they very much did radar systems. Absolutely. Yeah. And so they did navigation systems for the Navy and for Royal Caribbean. So if you happen to be listening to this and you've ever been on a Royal Caribbean, and if you've ever been on a Royal Caribbean cruise and you got to your destination, even though I never worked on that particular piece of code, I'll still tell you.
Your life was in Casey's hands.
Your life was in my hands. But no, I mean, all kidding aside, I think one of the first things I did at Sperry was work on the man overboard indicator. So if you're on a Navy ship and somebody goes in the drink, there's a MOB button and you could hit that and you would see a little floaty guy. I hope this isn't, you know, something I shouldn't be talking about publicly, but whatever.
Whatever. This is awesome, though. This is not like how to murder somebody 101. Right. This is awesome.
The origin of the feed icon.
So wait, how would that happen? Like you would have it on your person, like the guy would have it on himself and he would hit the button?
No. So you would be in the bridge and you would hear, oh, there's a man overboard, and you'd hit the MOB button. And then immediately there would be a little guy, and you can't see me, but imagine like a little icon of just a head and two arms sticking out of the water. And that was the icon. And basically what the navigation system did was dead reckoning based on the current and your speed at the time you hit the button and so on and so forth.
That's fucking awesome.
So it would give a best guesstimate as to where you need to turn around to find this person. Because you got to figure, you know, these are on carriers and destroyers, and these things don't turn on a dime. Right. And so that becomes very, very important.
Yeah. I mean, the guy could go over. Well, first of all, I don't know, if you fall off a carrier, you're likely dead. That's pretty
hard. Yeah.
But I mean, even if you just stop moving immediately, forget it. You're way, like, it's far.
I mean, if you cut the propellers instantly, to your point, you're still going several hundred yards, if not like a damn mile. Yeah. So it's
factor in currents too, because it's not like a flat. It's not like you're playing on a, it's not fair. It's not like a soccer field or a football field where, like, if you drop something and you move a bit, you know where it is. It's like, it's the water and the ocean and, you know.
Yeah. Things are
dynamic. Yeah.
And that's the thing. So I went from debugging by playing games to debugging by watching this little icon float down the screen. And it was wild. And so that was Windows, but it was still C++ at the time.
So were you worried about that? I mean,
yeah,
that's absolutely exactly the kind of thing where I'd be like, if I screw this up, somebody can just die.
Yes, and I don't think you mean that jokingly, but
no, I don't. I really
but
don't.
To be clear, I am saying completely sincerely that it did scare me a bit, and thankfully, I never worked on anything that I would personally classify as a tremendously big deal. And I know that sounds flippant given I just talked about men being overboard, but when I was working on man overboard stuff, it was like a bug fix, so it was a fairly compartmentalized thing that I needed to do. And what I learned quickly at Sperry / Northrop Grumman was that there is such a thing as procedures. And in certain circumstances, having a lot of procedures is very, very important. So like I had never done a code review before and suddenly code reviews were mandatory. And at first I begrudged it, partially because I was scared that they would find out I was a fraud or something. Right. And partially because I thought it was stupid. Who are you to tell me my code is shit? And then as it turned out, by the time I left, I absolutely cherished them, because no matter how good my code was, I always learned something. Always, always, always. I may not change my code, although oftentimes I did, but I would always learn a different perspective, even on the stuff I wrote myself, which was extremely valuable.
I totally agree. And if you guys ever do that ATP episode on
software methodologies,
I will tune in. Somebody was asking us to do that today. somebody tweeted that we should do that with you. But you can have that.
We'll get to it.
Yeah. So how long were you there for?
So I was there for 2.5 years, roughly, and about a year of that was working in that navigation system. And then the latter year and a half or so, maybe a year or so, was working in C sharp. And that's when I made the transition to C sharp. And I did that because we ended up working on a couple of proof of concept kind of R&D products, which was weird for a government contractor because you wouldn't think right. that we would want to bother with R&D, but we did. And actually, one of those projects particularly was probably the most fun I've had in my career to date.
Which is?
And so what we were doing there.
You're teasing. It's like next week.
Right. I didn't know if you wanted me to go there or not. But so what we did was this was around the time, it was a couple of years after, I believe it was the USS Cole was terrorized. And I believe, if memory serves, a couple of terrorists got themselves onto like a little rowboat or like a Zodiac. That's the word I was looking for.
Zodiac,
got into a Zodiac.
Yeah,
with a bomb and blew up the side of this warship. And so the Navy quite understandably realized, well, holy shit, we really need to take nearby security much more seriously.
Right. Just for the record, the Cole wasn't sunk. I think a few crew members died. I'm not sure
what
it was.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But the compartmentalization sort of took care of the damage.
Right, exactly right. And I believe this was off the coast of like Yemen or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal and it made some waves. Such a terrible uh-huh. accidental pun, but it made some waves.
No, that was a huge. I mean, I think it was actually Al Qaeda.
I think you're right. And again, my details
I don't want to, again, fuzzy, but. This, we're going far astray from the tech topics. I didn't research this, but I believe it was an Al Qaeda, yeah. like an earlier Al Qaeda attack.
I think that's right. So our R&D project was, hey, let's combine this third-party video tracking software and remote cameras mounted on a pan and tilt motor. And so what that means is if you sprinkle a few of these pan tilt cameras around the ship
yeah.
and you connect it to some software that we wrote in C sharp, then you could watch these video feeds and leveraging this video tracking software, you could actually with a joystick lock on to something in the video feed and it would automatically track that thing as it approached or went by or whatever the case may be. So the idea is if this Zodiac is coming at you, you can see it, first of all. To begin with, you can even see that it's there. And then secondly, once you see it, you can lock onto it with this video tracker and this camera will follow that thing as it's approaching you. Well, at the time we were dealing with it, we were just dealing with cameras and at worst, a very, very bright spotlight. But it was clear that the next step would be perhaps to arm the pan tilt mount so you could actually fire upon
yeah.
these intruders or attackers. And the
phalanx anti-missile yes. thing, right?
Something yeah. like that. So the idea of the project was, hey, you know, let's take you and this, and actually a friend of mine from back at Virginia Tech who was working there as well, the two of you guys and one electrical engineer. So it was me and another coder and a double E who also went to tech, although we didn't know him. The three of you guys who were...
you call them double E's?
Yeah, electrical engineer. And so it was the three of us. And I think between the three of us, we were each 20, I don't know, this was 22, 24 years old, something like that. So we'll take you three, basically children, and go off and build this thing. And by the way, we need it to be working in a month or 2 months, whatever it was. The point being, it was soup to nuts, all on us. Yeah. And it was an absolutely unreasonable deadline. And as with so many things in
that's
life,
do it.
But especially in software development, that's kind of the way to do it because you don't have time to fuck around. You just have to get it done. And we did this in .NET 1.1, which was the very first real version of .NET. Mm-hmm. And we did it using .NET remoting, which I believe was removed in .NET 2. but we did this thing where you could network a couple of these terminals and you could see these pan tilt cameras and interface with the joystick and interface with the motion tracking software. And we demoed it down in Virginia Beach at a Northrop Grumman facility down there for the Navy a couple of months later. And it was unbelievably rewarding because from
is that the demo where you actually just shot up kayakers?
Actually, you joke, but what we ended up doing was so this was in Charlottesville still, and Charlottesville is a solid 2 to 3 hours from the nearest ocean, which is, you know, the Atlantic. And so what we ended up doing was we sent out the company's yacht, which was like this 25, 30 foot boat that we had all of our radar and all of our navigation equipment on. Yeah. And then we like had somebody either we knew or maybe we rented like a cigarette boat, and the two of them would buzz back and forth in the bay that the building the demo was in was off of. Mm-hmm. And so we had the cameras mounted on the top of the building, and these boats would go and buzz the bay, and we would lock onto them. And so we had like different choreography so that like the cigarette boat would buzz in and then leave really fast. And the yacht would just kind of lumber along, you know, left to right in the background. And it was extremely cool. And it was so empowering, especially as a young developer, to right. take something from soup to nuts and to have that responsibility and to be trusted with that. And it was
building Iron Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back to Tony Stark.
Man.
So I want to get into this a little bit. Why did you choose .NET? As you said, it was 1.1, sort of the first initial mm-hmm. usable version of it. And so you didn't have experience with it necessarily.
I had very, very little. I had enough that I could barely get by.
But you know what I mean? That's a bit of a gamble. Like, we need to mm-hmm. get this done, and we need it in a couple of months. Let's try something new. Like, what was the thinking behind that?
Yeah. I wasn't the one who made the decision. It was my buddy that had, and we were the same age, but I would say he was certainly at the time, if not now, a better developer than I was. And so I think the thinking was we knew there was some amount of company knowledge about it. The next generation of the navigation system. So it was the commercial generation was the one that was really, really advanced, and mm-hmm. and the military, this sounds terrible, but the commercial one was on the fancy technology that was untested, is a better way of phrasing it, right. which in this case was .NET. And the military one was on C++ and had been around forever. And so there was some institutional...
No, that totally makes sense. That's
right.
The rational thing to do.
Yeah, because you can spare a cruise ship a lot easier than you can spare a submarine in war. As terrible as that sounds, that's the kind of decision.
It's awful to think about, but
yeah. So there was some institutional knowledge. And again, I'd done a little bit of C# in school, and I'd actually on my own, because I'm a nerd, had written a very, very, very basic time tracking tool in C#, kind of to teach myself or reteach myself C#. And so again, I had enough that I could get by. And the idea was we needed something that we could develop in rapidly. And of course, you know, Ruby developers, and this wasn't the web, this was native, but nevertheless, Ruby developers like, oh, you can't do anything quickly in .NET. Oh. But at the time, I mean, it was the best.
Well,
wait,
Ruby didn't even exist at the time.
This was 06, 06-ish.
Okay, so maybe.
So it might have been there, but it was very, very young as well.
Right. Yeah.
So we just needed something that would work quickly, and we didn't want to have to worry about. There were things that we wanted to worry about and things that we didn't. And one of the things we didn't want to have to worry about was memory management, as an example. Not to say that was a deliberate like line item on the yes no spreadsheet, if you will, but it's an example of something that made it quicker.
Yeah, again, I don't want to get into that language. I want to talk a lot about language, but I don't want to get into that Copeland 2010 thing.
Exactly.
What's his name talks about all the time.
That
whatever. Can't forget that guy's name. So you'd had done a lot of development in C++. Mm-hmm. What didn't you like about it?
About C++?
Yeah.
It was even then, and at the time, I was pretty good at C++. I wasn't amazing, but I was pretty good. And even then, I think I realized that it was extremely fiddly. Mm-hmm. And I stand by that to this day, that you can do amazingly powerful things in C++, but everything was on you. And I mean, there was a standard template library, and that made things easier, but it was just ugly and it was wonky. And so everything was on you, and everything was very fiddly. There were very concrete rules about how to do things, but they were very esoteric all at the same time. And it was hard.
A lot of personality in it rather than culture.
Yes, very much so.
It sounds weird. By culture, I mean, like in Objective-C, everybody pretty much names their methods the same way. In C++, it's like whatever. It's whatever comes to mind, and it is the personality that the programmer comes through a lot more.
Although at the comedy behind all this, though, is that the project had started on like some other sort of operating system. I can't remember for life me what it was, but I think it had been on like some weirdo real-time OS, and then I think it might have even gone through DOS well before I got my hands on it, and then eventually was ported to Windows. And so it was old enough that STL wasn't really a thing. And so the standard template library gave you things like strings, for example.
Right.
And so we had our own strings, and
which is that is a classic C++ thing.
Right.
Even C thing. It's like you have five different ways of representing a string, and you need to convert between them just to pass between API levels. And it's the worst.
It's so fiddly, and it's so silly, and it's contrary to the problem you're trying to solve. And I guess actually reflecting on it now, that was what bothered me about it, is not that it was a bad language, but a lot of the things that I had to worry about, a lot of the, as you know, cliche as it sounds, a lot of the cognitive load that I had was worrying about what form of string do I have, and what do I need to convert it to? And that's just silly, and it's just unnecessary. But anyway, I bring all this up because we had our own strings and our own latitude and longitude and all these other things. And actually, I didn't reflect on it until this very moment, but they were all prefixed. So I think it was like SK string and SK lat and SK long. And that sounds a lot like Objective-C today. So it's funny how these things kind of pop up.
Does that bug you? I mean, I don't want to get too deep into this, but everybody wants namespaces in Objective-C, and I just don't see that as a major problem.
It bothers me. I think more because while namespaces are a thing in C++, they're very, very big in C#. And some things that I miss about C# when I write code in Objective-C are namespaces, are things like nested classes. So if I have some sort of code unit in C# that it's its own thing, but isn't really relevant outside of this other thing, I can actually write a class and have another class that's nested within it. And yes, I can export that publicly, but oftentimes I won't. And so, I don't know, you could make a very valid argument that this is over-compartmentalizing and over-organizing, but as someone who's fairly anal retentive, I actually very much like that. And I like having namespaces. Namespaces are taken very seriously in C#.
Okay, but what's the difference between that sort of private internal class and just declaring it inside your .m file?
And not
exporting the interface, you know what I mean? Into the
I do. I do. Yeah. And to be honest, nothing really. I think it just aesthetically looks a little cleaner.
Sure.
But I mean, to be honest, Objective-C is hideous even once you get
the... Oh, really? You haven't...
I can see
sort
the
of adopted the yeah.
Yeah, I can see the matrix, and so it doesn't actively bother me, but if I look at it, it's one of those things where it's hideous because it's different. It's not that it's hideous because it's bad, it's hideous because it's different. And I get dragged back into it being, or back into the opinion of it being hideous, because I live and do my working life in C#. And so because of that, I'm reminded that there are freaking array references all over the place in Objective-C. And once I flip my brain back into look at the matrix mode, I don't even think about it. But
I'm the other way. Like when I look at, I can read C++ code and even C# code. But to me, it looks just insane. Like I'm married to Objective-C. Like I wake up in the morning and she's lying next to me. Like, hey, you're the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. So, you know, we hang out a lot.
Right.
So yeah, I get the inverse way, but I can see what you mean. It's like it is different. It is drastically different looking. Like the way you declare a method is kind of bananas. Like
why is it
like a minus sign?
Exactly. I was just gonna say the same thing.
Why is that there? Yep. Why is it there? Because it's beautiful. That's why it's there. That's why a plus sign. Just more beautiful. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
And it totally makes sense in the word static.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay, so let's get into C# because I want to learn C#.
Okay.
I want to learn about why people love C#. When it first came out, was I working? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was in the game industry at the time. Bought the book. I forget which book it was, but it was orange, I believe. Read it all, tried a little bit, liked it, thought it was way better than a lot of the garbage that was going on at the time with, what was it, AFL? ATL, the Advanced Type, like, whatever, the garbage, the previous garbage that had preceded Microsoft development environments was pretty bad. C Sharp was good. It was a bit of a ripoff of Java.
Oh, God, a bit? That's being generous. It was a complete ripoff of Java.
I know, but Microsoft is in such a low spot these days. I just want to be so...
Is there a better time to kick a man?
Yeah, I just, you know... So they took Java and they literally, they might even have hired a guy. I think they hired a guy from Borland in order to do it. It was good. It was smart. And it seemed interesting to me. But at the same time, for a couple of years before, I'd already sort of fallen in love with Objective-C. So it didn't seem as shiny to me. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, oh, look, you're catching up in a few of these ways. And it's interesting, but you're not quite. I like Objective-C because it is lower level too, in a way.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. It's very weird. It's hard to effectively describe the differences between the two because in many ways, I would argue in many ways they're very complementary. And
yeah, I think so.
I would say that I don't know if I'd go so far as an expert in C Sharp, but I'm pretty good. And I am somewhere between a novice and barely intermediate level in Objective-C.
Yeah, just for the listeners, Casey's a humble guy, so don't calibrate accordingly.
Don't take the self-deprecation seriously.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, so the point is, I might have a slightly skewed opinion of Objective-C especially, but to me, Objective-C is, and I think you touched on this earlier, very opinionated. And there are different ways to solve a problem. But generally speaking, in Objective-C, there's pretty much one clear winner. And I don't think the language is designed specifically to dictate that there is only one way to solve this problem, like some other languages are.
There's a culture around it. There's like is the way it happens, and that's
right. You know, yeah. Exactly. Whereas C Sharp, it to some degree is all things to all people, and that's more so now than it was in the past. But over the years, as it's added things like the dynamic language runtime to support more dynamic languages in this, you know, completely non-dynamic runtime and to support, I'm trying to think of other examples like Link, language integrated query, and a bunch of other stuff. It's gotten to be much wider reaching. F-sharp, which is a truly functional language, even though I know very little about it. Actually, in fact, I know pretty much nothing about it. It's gotten to the point that it can be, C-sharp can kind of be molded into being whatever you want it to be. Right. And that's both great and empowering, and it's also kind of scary all at the same time. Whereas,
let's back off a bit and explain a little bit about what C-sharp is, because C-sharp is not simply the language. There's the common language runtime that sits below it, which is where F Sharp and maybe Link executes in there.
Well, I mean, you could argue everything executes in there. So the idea behind the idea behind C Sharp, and my understanding is the Java runtime was JLR or something like that.
It
doesn't matter. So basically everything in C Sharp, you could just say Java did it. No, almost everything anyway. And so
but you can say that about any computer thing. It's like, sure, it's been done before. Yes, but this is different. So
exactly. And so basically what happens is when I compile C Sharp code, I compile it into Microsoft Intermediary Language, MSIL or MISL. Yeah. And then from there it's compiled. It's just in time compiled on the common language runtime. So let me back up a bit. I compile to this like phantom processor that doesn't really exist, and that's what MISL is. It's basically assembly language against a processor that doesn't exist.
Right.
And then the idea is when you actually run your code, your MISL code, it will recompile, is probably not the right term for it, but kind of sort of recompile this assembly language compilation into the native assembly language that your actual microprocessor speaks.
Yep.
And so it's this weird intermediary step. And so what's interesting about that, though, is you can feed anything that can be converted into missile can be run on the common language runtime, which is that just-in-time runtime. And so that means you can do C Sharp. You can do Python by way of Iron Python. You can do Ruby by way of Iron Ruby, Iron Python and Iron Ruby being the projects that are the compilers. You can do Visual Basic. You can do C++. You can put almost anything into this and get missile out of it. And that's extremely powerful.
Yeah, because you know what? You also get to interoperate.
Yeah, exactly right. And that makes it very cool. And as a matter of fact, at my last job, I wrote just a proof of concept thing where we needed a business language or business rules engine. And we had investigated a couple of third-party tools. And I thought, well, you know, the power user could probably use Python just fine. And I wrote a very, very, very basic Python interpreter in C Sharp, which just leveraged Iron Python to do all the heavy lifting. And I think it was like 400 lines of code or something like that, probably less. It was very, very, very little code. Mm-hmm. And so you could run Python and pass variables back and forth. And it was very, 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 very cool.
That's great. I actually also used Python. I embedded it into a game engine years ago.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, so that, you know, if you're a level designer, you are effectively a power user. Like your job is to work with computers. You know what you're doing, and you hand them Python, and wow, it's unbelievable how much use and the things that they can kind of do with that kind of flexibility. Mm-hmm. So that's great, because that is exactly the kind of thing that I don't think you could do with Objective-C as easily.
No,
although I mean I have done Lua scripting and stuff, but still it's
Well, it's not really meant for it, right?
So the thing is, when I do a Lua bridge or a bridge to another language, I'm really leveraging my low-level knowledge of how all the nuts and bolts fit together. And I don't think you need to do that if you're, you know, bridging C-sharp and you're using Iron Python and that kind of thing.
Not at all. And you do need to get into that sort of more low-level stuff if you're doing something like calling into C++ or calling into C, or if you're using COM, component object model, which was a Windows thing, or I believe it was unique to Windows, where
it's on the Mac too.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
No, there you go.
Component object model. Yeah.
Yep. And so it was this thing which allowed you to communicate between processes of different languages and so on and so forth, and actually was ref counted, which was my first real exposure to reference counting, which became useful later when I learned Objective-C. So,
yes.
Your point is
dead on. I interface, yep. I think, has a ref counting.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly right.
I mean, you don't need to know that, you know, this kind of parameter fits in this many bits. Or, you know, like a bool return is a byte, so you need to only use the...
The only time you get into that is when you're what's called P-invoking or platform invoking, which is to say you're calling into some entirely other technology, something like COM or something like C++, or like if you were to make a...
But that's because they're low level and they mean business at a machine level, you know?
Yeah. Right. So if you had an instance where you had to reach outside of the .NET framework in order to get to some Win32 API that they hadn't encapsulated within C# and .NET, then you would need to P-invoke it, and you would need to worry about, okay, is this, you know, big Endian, little Endian? How many bits is this? How many bytes is that? So on and so forth. But that is very rare, and I've only had to do that a handful of times in my career.
So sell me on C#. What's the environment like? Like, how do you, you know, make me an app? Talk me through it.
Yeah. So C# is wonderful because, like I said, it kind of does a little bit of everything. And you could argue and make a legitimate argument that that's dangerous or bad. But I think by and large, especially if you know what you're doing, it's very powerful. And so as an example, let's look at web development, which I know is not what you usually do, at least as far as I knew. It's not what you usually do, but it's a great example. So and originally there was something called WinForms, which was writing GUI apps for Windows. And it was all event-driven, which is what you would expect. So, you know, if a button was clicked, it would call, you know, it would call an event or fire an event that said, oh, this button was clicked, and you could handle it and do what you want. It was all asynchronous and so on and so forth. Well, Microsoft decided we have a lot of Windows developers writing WinForms apps in C Sharp. We should try to make that same sort of model work for the web. And so we should do this event-driven thing that totally abstracts you from the fact that you're really operating across the web, which is this completely stateless, not really in any way equivalent model. And so that's what they did with web forms. So it looks almost identical to WinForms. And in fact, that was my first web development. My first real web development was web forms. But in reality, they're just obfuscating the fact that, or putting kind of an adapter or facade, if you will, in front of the fact that you're working on the web. So when you have a button that's clicked and that fires a post back to the server calls your code by saying, hey, this event just happened. This button was just clicked. So as a WinForms guy, it was great. It was very easy to learn. But it was, in reality, a terrible freaking way of writing websites. It just abysmal. But the reason I bring this up is because then a few years later, Microsoft did what Microsoft does best, which is it totally bogarted somebody else's technology. And so fast forward
a few
years. But it's
true. I just want to give them a big hug at this point.
I know. And I do too. And to be fair, for the last, what, 6-7 years of my life, maybe even more than that, I've been writing C Sharp, which is a Microsoft language, and I've made a pretty good living at it. So yeah. I owe them a lot. And I'm not trying to brush that under the rug. Yeah. But hey, regardless,
you know, you got a shitty car out of it.
I see what you did there. So, so what they did was Microsoft said, hey, this Ruby on Rails thing looks pretty sweet. And this whole convention over configuration thing, that looks kind of cool. And I don't actually may not have started within Microsoft, but Microsoft quickly enveloped it, even if it didn't. And so that became ASP.NET MVC. ASP, so there's classic ASP, which is not what I was talking about. That was just awful. That was kind of PHP-ish.
Active server
pages. Yep. Mm-hmm. Kind of like PHP, and it was just freaking terrible. Yeah. Then there was ASP.NET.
I do love that they take ideas, but they kind of make them
painful.
It's not like they, I don't know. It's weird because Microsoft used to, like, what was it? Embrace and extinguish?
Embrace, extend, extinguish.
That was it.
You got it.
I don't know. Sometimes they weigh those three things differently, and sometimes it goes in a weird way where you get like ASP, which is effectively, it's like, well, we're going to take the idea of PHP and do something that's just not even as good.
Yeah, and murder it.
There was an exacerbate in the middle that we forgot to mention.
Well done. Yeah. That's a good call, Renee.
But I do want to say one of the skills is they pay attention to the industry.
Yes, very much so. And so what they did was it might have started open source and still is open source, but one way or another, they saw Ruby on Rails and said, you know what? Rather than this very configuration heavy way of doing things, which is the Microsoft way of doing things, it's terrible. Let's take MVC let's take Ruby on Rails and try to embrace that. And fast forward just another couple years later, and MVC is, from every measure I've ever heard, from people who have done both Ruby and MVC, it is nearly as good as Ruby, if not in certain ways better.
That's cool. So wait, it's mostly convention-based?
Absolutely.
Which is kind of the Ruby Objective-C-ish kind of way of looking at the world, right? Where if you write your code, it goes back to that culture versus personality thing. Mm-hmm. It's like if you fit into the culture, things will just work.
Right, exactly right.
If you insist on being, you know, expressing your own personality, then you're going to have some more work to do in order to make everything fit together.
Right, which
is
different.
That sounds like it could be on a self-help show. But
it's true, though. No, it's true. Whereas in C#, it was basically a blank slate, and they said, go to town. And as time has gone on, it's been coming closer to being opinionated, but very, very lightly so, unless you get to something like MVC, which is very opinionated, but that's the whole design of it, is to be opinionated. And so I've not done Ruby on Rails, but from what very, very little I know, it is a lot of the same benefits of Ruby on Rails, which is convention over configuration, which is rapid setup, rapid, not even prototyping, rapid development, all within a C# and Microsoft world. And so that's very cool. And it's nice to see that the language hasn't stagnated. And whether or not you're of the opinion that
it's on version 5 or something now, right?
I don't know if
it's out. Maybe that's a bit high. Okay, but they're revving pretty quickly. They're not. Yeah.
Well, 4.5 is absolutely a thing, and I think 5 is coming soon. I'm always a version or two behind because I'm usually using some sort of enterprise CMS. Yeah. So
you got to work, right?
Right, exactly. But yeah. So the point is, it's just it's very very cool that they keep active and the community is active in ways that I think the Objective-C and Cocoa communities are becoming active. And I'm looking at things, for example, like CocoaPods. Mm-hmm. You know, Microsoft has had NuGet, N-U-G-E-T, for a little bit longer than CocoaPods, but that's just one silly example of like a package manager. And the community has always been good. And the nice thing is there's so many freaking idiots that write in Microsoft technologies that somebody has stumbled upon every single problem under the sun. Mm. And if you're willing to spend enough time Googling, you can find an answer. Now, it may not be the right answer, which is why those of us who are good at what we do get paid a little more than those that don't, that aren't, but it's an answer. And right. So it's really nice. And so to kind of summarize and put a bow around this long rambly me selling you on C#, the other thing that's really wonderful is Visual Studio is really an incredible IDE. It's so incredible that it's almost crippling. And what I mean by that is
you don't actually need to sell me on that. It is. I worked in it for years, many years, mm-hmm. like over a decade.
And you know,
wow, it's good.
Yeah,
it really got a little worse, but maybe it's better now. Who knows?
I mean, it kind of comes and goes in waves, but by and large, it really is incredible. And it's so good that, for example, IntelliSense, which is what happens. You know, if you're in C#, everything is what Objective-C programmers call dot syntax. And so if you do, you know, some instance dot, you know, this pop-up comes up at your cursor and it's a list of methods you can call on that class. And a few months ago, I was writing an iPad app for work, actually. And we took one of our really, really incredibly good C# developers who actually used to work at Microsoft and had him help out in this iPad app. And he had never done Objective-C, never done Cocoa, and he actually picked it up extremely quickly. But the thing that was hardest for him in Xcode was figuring out the Cocoa Touch framework because he didn't have good IntelliSense. And that's all a Microsoft programmer really needs. You don't really need
have good intelligence. IntelliSense was better than what Xcode does 10 years ago.
Yep.
Like it was remarkably good at doing what it was meant to do. And Cocoa really kind of needs it because there's a rich framework there, but it's not always clear what do you want to be doing at a certain time. And because of the culture of it, you feel that there's enough context that it could be doing such a better job and it's just not.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I've struggled with Cocoa, with learning Objective-C and Cocoa, is that it's very hard for a novice to learn what the right way of doing things is. And a lot of time, and that's true anywhere, of course, but I don't feel, because there's so comparatively.
Well,
because
it's different than other platforms too, right?
Yes. It's different and there's so few of you guys, and by comparison anyway.
I don't know if that's still true. Maybe.
Well, you got to think there's a lot of people writing on Microsoft technology.
I guess so.
Maybe not independent people, you know, they're all corporate stooges like me, but nevertheless, there's a zillion of us. Whereas comparatively, certainly up until very recently, if not still, there's.
Yeah, I do feel like, the people that know what they're talking about on Objective-C pretty much fit in a bar. I'm pretty sure I can prove that.
Yeah. You're exactly right. And so there's a smaller community, which makes it harder. And a lot of it is just kind of, knowledge that you've gained over years of doing it wrong, and not a lot of that is shared. And I don't mean that in an accusatory way, and I don't begrudge that. It's just, you know, there's not enough to really share with, you know, and the only people you want to share with are the people that already know anyway. So
that's interesting. So do you think, it's funny because I've never actually really thought of myself as being in the Objective-C
community,
landed gentry. No, but in the old guard, really.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I guess in a way I am. I mean, I've been doing it for.
You were on the next Mayflower.
I almost was. Yeah, I think I was like in a rowboat behind it, but yeah, like, close. So yeah, I have been doing this for a long time. What could the people with a lot of experience do better to help people like you that are coming to the language?
You know, it's a great question. I think some of that is happening. So some things like, what is it? Objective-C.io, I believe.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Ooh, I think it could just be obj.io.
You know what I'm thinking of, though.
It's that awesome magazine that everybody should read. And man, I wish I could remember the name because it.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll have to look it up. Like, we really, really have to look it up because it's incredibly good.
Exactly. And Matt Thompson.
Yeah.
His NFC.
He's at Panic now. Congrats, Matt.
Oh, he's at Panic?
I believe so. Yeah. Like, traditionally. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Well, anyway, so his NS Hipster is also very good. And it's things like that that I think are best. And the problem is maybe I'm just begrudging Coco Touch because I'm ignorant of it, not because it's not because the community is necessarily worse. Maybe part of it is that when you see an answer to a question on Stack Overflow that relates to C#, mm-hmm. usually it's pretty obvious that that person has answered the question, but has done so completely wrongly. And okay. If you know what you're doing, it's pretty easy to figure out. That's the, I think, the missing piece. If you know what you're doing, even a little bit, it's easy to figure out what the right answer is.
Yeah. Whereas, you know what shit is like, yeah. Okay. I'm when I see an answer on Stack Overflow about Objective-C, I'm like, that's mostly wrong. Like, mm-hmm. so maybe it's just a question of the experience and perspective.
Yeah. And the more I talk and the more I think about it, the more I wonder if maybe I'm begrudging the community for my own ignorance, but
no. That's, we love you, Casey.
But yeah, I mean, it's just tough. And the other thing is Objective-C, not only is it opinionated, but it is a very, very different language and framework from everything else in the world. And here again, I'll pick on my friend Jamie. I remember I was writing something in Objective-C, I think when I was just trying to teach myself, and I wanted to do something with dates. And I've told this story a couple times in various places. I wanted to do something with dates, and I think I wanted to convert like a plain text or an NS date into something that's human readable.
Yeah.
And so to do that in .NET, there is one date time class. And there's a method on every class that's the approximate equivalent of description. In Objective-C, but we call it toString. And so I could call date.toString, hand it no parameters, and get a reasonable human readable date and time string out of it. Yeah. Whereas to do the equivalent in Objective-C, and I think I'm getting my problem slightly, it was slightly more complex.
Who cares?
You needed like four different classes. You needed like NSState components. You needed NSState. You needed like two or three other classes. And it was just ridiculous. And so I was bitching to my friend Jamie. I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Why isn't there just one date time class? This is so overly heavy and stupid. Yeah. And then he looked me dead in the eyes and he said, all right, hold on though. Is it that it's dumb and stupid, or is it just properly abstracted?
Right.
And as silly as that sounds, and that may sound like a cop-out, but I thought about it for a second and my mind exploded because I realized, you know what? He's right. And even though it seems on the surface to be way harder than it needs to be, in actuality, it's just abstracted the way it really should be.
I tend to agree. I mean, maybe that's like it's kind of my culture at this point. So maybe I'm like, hey, of course. Yeah, that's awesome. Like, it's like ethnocentric in a way. Big words, baby. That's what we do here. But yeah. And especially for dates, it's like, you think that's simple.
Yeah.
Like there's like a C API that I can't even remember this time. It'll get you a date. And it's just, that's nice. You can get a date, but you're not doing
right.
You're not doing it right. You're not, you know, like dates, having written software that has, you know, required precise date and times across time zones and all kinds of bizarre crap. It's hard. It is not an easy problem. So yeah, you look at it and you're like, what the fuck? I just want the goddamn date. This is not hard. But when you actually understand the problem space, it's like, okay, so it's, you know, it's more complex than I want. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be just a dead simple way to get what you want to do. And I think the text system in Coco, in AppKit at least, is sort of the shining example of that, where it is incredibly complicated. It supports all kinds of crazy stuff. And yet you can get it by just dragging and dropping an NS text view in your document.
Right. And I think that's kind of the difference. Perhaps to some degree, it's the difference in ideology between the .NET framework and Cocoa. And mm-hmm. even though I will tell you that I genuinely believe, hand on heart, that Cocoa is an unbelievably wonderful framework, and it really is incredible. But it is.
You really don't need to oversell it.
But it's true. And but the thing is, it's not as approachable though. And I think that's really what all my bitching and moaning is really coming down to, is that it's a lot less approachable, and that's what's tough.
So I mean, I approached it 15 years ago, so it was not. Wow, was it that long? Whatever.
God, you're old.
Yeah, I am, actually. I turn like 96 next week.
That's in programmer years, though.
I forgot what I was saying.
I got
too old. When I approached Cocoa, it was complicated, and it had been around for, let's say, 89, whatever. I think it had existed for 15 years. And I got to it just as it got on the Mac, basically. It was like night and day. I'm like, this. I would program games at work and come home and program Mac apps, because it was just, it was a different thing. This is kind of more fun. It's a little bit weird that your hobby is like writing productivity software on the Mac and your day job is writing games.
Explains so much.
But whatever. It's like, that's what it was, just because it was like night and day different. Like, it felt like I was in a totally different world. But I eventually adapted to it. I think about half of that time period later, sort of when the iPhone was introduced, the UI kit and Cocoa Touch sort of rebooted the environment, which was a good time to get in, which is when Marco got in.
Yep.
And we're about the same amount of time between when Marco got in and now as we were between sort of like when the Mac OS X started and the iPhone came out. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're bisecting the timeline. I think now if you're jumping in, it's kind of hard. Like, there's a lot of established methodology, and like the APIs are robust and established, and there's not that sort of frontiersman sort of.
Well, it's not the Wild West anymore. It's been settled.
Yeah, not that it was ever the Wild West. Like, there was, you know, there was never drunken brothels or anything, but it was like a. Nobody ever got shot in the street for arguing about Cocoa, although dot syntax came close. but there's, again, I think we're getting back to the culture thing, where it's really like, you know, if you go and live in France, you seem like it'll be fine, but there's a cultural difference and a cultural expectation, a certain way of doing things. And I think coming to Objective-C and, you know, Cocoa is the same way. And it is very different from all the other languages. Just the way that – I think even just the basic method dispatch is what screws most people up. I think that it flips a switch in their head that's like, this is – I'm in alien land. This is bananas.
Well, I mean, to give a concrete example of that, as a C# developer, I'm doing null checking everywhere.
Yep.
Because if I try to call a method on something that's null, I get a null reference exception. Whereas I can pass messages to things that are nil in Objective-C all day long. And within reason, it's almost never going to bite me unless I allow it to. And that's just a very, very different mindset. And that's not bad. It's not a bad thing at all. It's just very different, and very different than the more, air quote, traditional languages that most of us have cut our teeth in.
Right. Well, I think the essential concept behind Objective-C is not that you have basically a struct of data and a set of functions that work on it. And you can, you know, as in C++, you can dispatch them by dereferencing that struct and looking up the mm-hmm. function pointer. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have an object and you can send it a message.
Yeah.
And it sounds like silly that that's a distinction, but it's not. There's like, you don't call, we say calling methods all the time, but you're not. If you have to think about it, of like, I'm sending this thing a message. It's going to be dynamically looked up. And when you think of it that way, sending a message to null is like, well, that just makes sense. It should just work, right?
Yeah. And it's so weird. And again, it's actually empowering, but it's so weird and different. But it's very cool. It's something that I'm very glad that I've picked up, even if I never make anything of it professionally. And I'd like to. And in fact, I'm trying very hard at work to angle us more towards mobile. Yeah. But nevertheless, it's extremely empowering to have learned it. And one of the funny things about when I taught myself Objective-C was that I found that, among other things, my method names in C# got considerably longer. more descriptive.
And that's
I don't mean that in a dismissive way at all. I mean that in an excellent way. Yeah. And I think that's,
I mean, that's
best.
One of the things I agree. I don't know. I've spent way too long arguing with what's his name about pretty much everything. But the concision argument for language is like, that's not compelling for me at all. You know, as I hit my 96th year, I realized it's like, the more words that you use, the more I'm going to understand what you're trying to say.
Sure.
So, you know, yeah.
Now, to go back a step, I was thinking a minute ago, you know, so how can I really sell Guy on C#? Not that you're really arguing it, but how can I sell it? And I think the thing that I love most about C# is that not only is it constantly getting better, which we can say of Objective-C as well, but it's getting better in frequently, and it's getting better in noticeable, tangible ways. So let me give you a few quick examples. In .NET 1.1, which was the first really usable one, we only had things like NSArray, we called it an array list, but it was just NSArray. And in C#,
you called it an array list.
Mm-hmm. Array list.
You're making fun of method names, and you call it an array list.
Yeah, I know. But there's a point here, so bear with me. Yeah. So we called it an array list, and it stored nothing but objects. Objects being the approximately
Here's an interesting question and distinction. Are those array lists type locked, like in C++, where it's like you can only put in objects of a certain type into it? Like NSArray, where it's like, this is just a bag of stuff.
That's the thing, is that in 1.1, everything was an array. It was an array list, and everything was the only thing that got stored in there was what effectively an NS object, so to speak. And so basically anything was in there. Right. Now, object in C# is kind of sort of a little bit ID or id or whatever you call it, and a little bit NS object. It's kind of a little bit of both. But suffice to say,
object is actually what they used to call it before it got all NS stuff. Exactly. No, seriously. There was an object class. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. So you would store objects in an array list. But the problem with that was, unlike in Objective-C, where you can pull something out of an NS array and just pass a message to it, assuming that that message will be responded to, it's different in C# because it's all statically typed. It's strongly typed. And so what you would need to do is do a cast every time you pulled something out of the array list. Mm-hmm. And that was annoying as fuck. .NET 2, they introduced generics, which I would argue would be really nice to have in Objective-C, but I'm probably wrong in arguing that.
You're way too humble. Just go with it.
The thing of it is that when you have that strong type information for the compiler, it can protect you from yourself. And to be fair, there's a lot less ways you can burn yourself in Objective-C by passing inappropriate messages, where instead of calling something on a class in C# that doesn't exist. I mean, but the point is, if you give the compiler hints about what you're putting in a collection, it can help you on the way out as well, and help you keep you from doing damage to yourself. But anyway, I digress. So the point is, in .NET 2, you got generics. So we got...
Wait, this is the way you're selling me on this?
Yeah. Just bear with me, man. So we got...
you're pushing me away, buddy. Come on.
So we got generics in .NET 2. And so that became list. It was just list. And then you could tell it what you're storing in there, in the same way you would have just dictionary. And you would say, well, the key is of such and such type, and the value is of such and such type. And so now, anytime you put something in or pulled something out of these collections, the compiler knew exactly what you were doing, and so you didn't have to cast all over the place. Right. And that made everything worlds better. It was really, really fantastic. So
That's but, so wait, what? So, I mean, so the benefit is, as a programmer, the compiler can help you because it's got type information, right?
Right. Well, it's twofold. One, the compiler can help you from being an idiot. And two, you type less because rather than casting every time you take something out of the collection, it already knows what went in the collection. So it knows.
Yeah, but in Objective-C, we don't cast.
That's the reason why I think my argument for generics in Objective-C is kind of shoddy.
It's a little bit weird. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's really, I'm placing a non-dynamic languages problem onto a rather dynamic language.
Right. I'll stop being a dick for a second, it's a rare moment. I agree. I think that, like, so that advancement that you're describing, that sounds awesome. That sounds like exactly the right way the language should be moving. But I think it addresses a problem that is
there's not really an equivalent problem in Objective-C.
Right. It's like it's born from the structure of the yes. static language in itself, and it fixes it, which is great. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it maps to this
correct.
Different
right.
world. Like one of the things with this Copeland 20 – oh, God. Sorry. It's your best plus. I don't know if we understand the problems at all or enough. And not the theoretical problems of like, well, in this language you can do X and isn't X interesting. I think – we need to understand, say, okay, what problems are you having writing software?
Right.
Day to day, like what are the actual things that are happening? I think storyboards, which I don't like, but I think storyboards are an effort to move along that sort of to attack that problem. Like, what do you do? Oh, you write a bunch of apps that are basically drilling down into data for your store or for whatever it is. So here's an easy way to do that.
Right. Like, but you're missing the obvious example, which is Arc. Arc, I think, was absolutely the best, but it was the best example of Objective-C moving in the right direction and us not needing to replace it, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't mean to defend Objective-C in that way. I'm just not sure that the problem as stated is quite the reality or quite the way we should be looking at it.
Right perspective.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm going to argue with you rather than what's his name.
to go back to me selling you on C#. So generics were fixing a problem with C# language, but that's just one step. So another great example is some syntactic sugar to make lambda expressions. So to make closures easier and better to use. And God knows that if any language could use some syntactic sugar to make closures better, it's Objective-C. And if you have a website called fuckingblocksyntax.com in order to figure out how to write closures, something is probably broken. Now, I understand why it's syntactically that way.
Right, that I was going to say. Yeah.
It makes sense, but couldn't we sprinkle something on this to make this problem easier? Something like object literals, which is another example of some syntactic sugar, which while stupid, makes a world of difference and makes things so much easier.
Totally agree. We're going along. First of all, I don't know why you guys pull your punches in ATP, but you should swear a lot more. Objective literals. And so let's explain this a little bit. Block syntax is the way it is in Objective-C because it's not part of Objective-C. It's in addition to the C language.
Right.
And Objective-C sort of sits atop that. But blocks are actually added below that, and you can call them from regular C code. And they are the way they are, and the syntax is the way it is. And I know Casey knows this, but I'm just going through to the listener. Is that has always been the way that you define function pointers in C. And function pointers in C have been a thing since like day zero. They just exist. And a function pointer is basically a pointer to, guess what, a function. And then you can dereference that and you can call it. So it's the way that you would use to do callbacks and stuff.
But blocks are a little bit more powerful than that because yes. they're closures. And so they capture the, not the state. What am I looking for?
The context around
Thank them. You. Yeah. The context around them, which is extremely powerful.
Yes, I totally agree. Now, the thing is, the syntax is exactly the same as a function pointer, except use the little chapeau. You use the carrot.
Chapeau. I was going to say, I was like, what?
Chapeau is hat in French. So.
Oh, you.
Shift six is the carrot, right? I don't know what you
yes.
call it.
Yes, it's a carrot.
It is a carrot. But for a second there, I was like, this must be some French thing because I have no fucking clue what he's talking about.
Folks.
Anyway,
it's a cultural show.
It's the chapeau expression. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's the reason the syntax is that way. And you know what? Like, I was using function pointers for years. And whenever it comes to writing a block, I still get screwed up.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, it breaks my head. I'm like, oh, wait, how do I do this? I don't even know. It definitely needs some kind of thing. But object literals were a huge win.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I think it can go a step further, but I think they don't just out of consistency's sake. Like if you're doing if you're using an object literal to express an array, inside that expression, I don't know why you would need to use object literals for each of the things. Items. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like at square brackets array. And then if there's a string in there, do you really need the at in front of the string or a number? It's you know that they're going to be objects because they're going into an array. So don't bother.
It's not going to be a char star. It's going to be an NS string.
Exactly.
It's not going to be an int. It's going to be an NS number. Yeah.
Right. But I think they don't do that just to keep things same.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's my final pitch in favor of C-sharp that in C-sharp's progress, and that's language integrated query, which I alluded to earlier.
Yep.
And
you
I talked.
You guys had a good discussion about this on ATP the other day.
Yeah.
Link.
LINQ. And so what that lets you do is there's two different forms for link. One of them is in code, you can write something that looks almost exactly like SQL. It's slightly different, but very similar. So you could say from some collection where some property equals something, select some series of properties. So you can whittle down something, some collection into some smaller collection. And what's important to realize about this, which I think John or whatever his name is, that Italian sounding guy.
I'll edit that out.
What John was having trouble not grasping but remembering was that you can do this against things other than databases, and it's an easy mistake to make because when Link first came out, it was really pitched as here's a great way to hit a database and not have to go through a bunch of boilerplate code to get to it. But Link is actually a lot more than that. You can do it against objects, and that's when I use Link 99% of the time is to clever things with objects. And these are...
And by objects, you mean collections?
Or? Yes, I'm sorry, collections. So,
no, don't be sorry. I'm curious. Okay,
So I could take like a dictionary or a list or whatever the case may be, and I can whittle down and make selections or do unions or you know, get distinct values between two different arrays or whatever the case may be.
So if I have an object, this is not what you're talking about, but if I have an object and I can... Can I call link on it and get like three of its properties and get them back in a dictionary type thing?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, you can make dictionaries out of objects. Typically what you're doing though is basic operations like sorting or filtering is the most obvious example. So like a great example is, you know, give me the first object that meets this predicate.
Right.
So, you know, find me the first one of those. And so you can do that in a SQL-like syntax, or you can use method chaining. So, you know, some array dot first dot where, you know, where, I'm sorry. So it'd be some array dot where dot first, you know, or you could even combine them into, you know, some array dot first or default, which will give you either null or the first thing that matches that predicate. And you can chain a bunch of these together and get some hyper complex link queries together. And what I failed to mention on ATP, and somebody actually wrote in and reminded me of this, is that if you look at NS predicate, which does roughly the same thing in Objective-C, it's you're expressing what you want to do by passing it a string.
Right.
Whereas in link, you're actually creating a what is it called? It's like a query tree. There's an expression tree. That's what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. You're creating an expression tree, and this, and the query isn't actually evaluated until the moment you need the result, which is interesting because you can build up.
Really?
This, yeah.
Oh, that isn't. So you get back, I don't know what they call it, but let's call it a future. Like it's like a token mm-hmm. that
yeah.
until you actually ask it for the value is unexpressed, right? It's not
exactly. So, okay. Yeah. So I can ask for a list that consists of a filtered subset of some other list, but until I actually use that list, that filter isn't performed.
So what happens with the mutable? Like what happens if one of the thing that you're querying is mutated behind your back? Like it turns into the Hulk or something.
Mm-hmm. Then I will get the most recent answer.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So you can evaluate that, that, what do they call it? Like what's the return value called?
Well, so that's the thing. It's very, very, very weird. It gets really dodgy. And to be honest, it's probably a little too in the weeds for this show. Not because it's just that we could go for hours is what I'm saying.
The show is the weeds.
Yeah. Well, what I mean is, if I ask for a link result and I might get the details wrong because I haven't been writing C# in a month or so. But if I ask for a link result against some filter of some collection, if I don't and I get a resultant collection back from it, or I really get in, what do I get, a queryable? God, I'm gonna get my details wrong. I'm gonna get so many emails. Yeah. But anyway, you get kind of a token. You described it well earlier. You get a token, and it's until I say convert whatever the result is to an array or convert it to a list or whatever the case may be, that expression, that filter isn't evaluated. And so a lot of times what I'll do is if I'm debugging, just to kind of maybe illustrate this, is if I'm debugging and I want to see the result of that link query immediately, I'll put on the very end of that method chain to array. So at that point, by putting it in an array, it forces it to evaluate right then and there.
Because it's not actually an array. There's nothing there. It's a thing. Correct. It's like
it's an expression tree. And so it's just waiting to be processed. What's interesting about the fact that it's an expression tree is, you know, you can kind of unwrap that and you can do I've never done any of this, but you can do some really wild stuff with that.
Yeah.
And that makes it extremely powerful. And there are two things that I've really wanted to do in C# that I've never had a good excuse to do. One of those things is emit code, because you can actually in C#, which has extraordinarily powerful reflection and easy reflection, you can actually emit code, compile it at runtime and use it right at runtime, which is really weird. And the other thing I want to be able to do.
Well, it's not that weird when you consider. It's weird for quote unquote real programming languages.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing I want to do is be able to play around with expression trees. Because to be honest, I understand the inputs and outputs of that black box, but the insides of that black box are completely
different
to me.
Yeah. So that fascinates me. I'd love that. I think that's very cool. No chance you're getting that on the iPhone. Sorry about that. It's probably not happening.
Well, but is that really true, though? Because something like Xamarin, which was once known as Monotouch, that would let you do it, as far as I know.
Well,
if only we
had that guest scheduled.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you ever have Miguel on, you should ask him about that, because I bet you he'll tell you that it's no sweat.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it's.
The
point I'm driving at, though.
I have done it. I mean, if you embed Lua or something, you can do something similar, right? Not quite the same, though.
No, but the point I'm driving at is over the span of 5 or 10 years, there have been absolutely noteworthy and almost fundamental differences to .NET that make it considerably better for your average programmer to get their job done.
Right.
So these aren't things that I wouldn't say they're as monumental and earth-shattering as Arc, and I don't mean that flippantly. I mean that genuinely.
No, I know it. Yeah, but small incremental improvements consistently—that's great. That's
exactly they're consistent, and so I don't know.
It's almost better than having to make a big leap like Arc. It's we're just building and building and building, and we don't have to. We don't have to fix anything major. So
exactly. And so that makes it powerful, and it makes it easy to stay entertained, because one of the things I've found is that when I get really good at something, it's hard for me to continue to enjoy doing it because I'm not really learning anything. And of course, I don't know everything there is to know about C sharp, and I never will, but I know a lot. I'm pretty good at C sharp. And there's two ways to keep me entertained with that. You either change the language in some way by adding link, by adding some new thing, or you have me do some sort of framework-y thing. And I'm thinking of, for example, that MVC stuff we were talking about earlier. You have me do that thing that I'm not familiar with, still within C sharp. And so that keeps me intrigued and keeps me interested. And I'm not the only person that thinks this way. And most good developers that I know, if they're not learning something constantly, they're getting bored. And the worst thing in the world is a good developer that's bored, because they get angry and they get feisty and they get impatient. And none of those are good things.
Yeah, that's why I hate everybody. No, I totally agree. I think that's an incredibly astute observation and very wise. If you're not learning, you're just typing.
You're dying.
And that's not what you, whatever it was that hooked you on doing this is not being tickled if you're not still struggling to sort of, you know, figure things out.
Yep.
Which is why I want to learn about this C-sharp.
Yeah,
thing, really, you know, is. Like it.
Yeah. It's very good. It really is.
Like, I like being told that no, I'm wrong, and I'm really interested in this link or some kind of way to integrate NS predicate into the language. Seems like a natural next step.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a little bit weird because I think that they would probably go with blocks rather than, you know, like arrays already have this way to filter using a block and all that, so it's a bit weird.
Yeah, and to be honest, if you were to look at the surface, I would argue filtering an array with a block is basically what a lot of these things in Link that I love so much are.
Yeah, you know, but it's not quite the
it's not quite the same. It's
there's the cherry on top of that sundae that's just so perfect. It's like, it's a live query, effectively, which isn't.
And that's very true. And the other thing is, not to beat on blocks anymore, but you know, it's so syntactically easy to declare what is the equivalent of a closure, the equivalent of a block in C sharp. Basically, it's open paren, whatever you want to call the parameters. You don't have to specify type. It's just whatever you're calling the parameters, close paren, space equals greater than. So it looks like an arrow. And then if you have more than one line, you would put in a, you know, curly bracket, curly brace, whatever you call it. And if you don't have more than one line, you don't even need to bother with that. And that's it. That's all you need, is basically the names of the variables for that inline method and then the method itself. That's it. Which is so much nicer. I've never had to refer to fucking landofsyntax.com because it doesn't even exist, you know, because it's so easy.
Well, fine. I mean, I guess there goes my career writing software for Apple. So one question I do have, and I know we're running along, and I really appreciate your time, so thanks.
My pleasure.
Yes, you're right. It is. this is not your argument to have, but
sure.
One of the questions I have regarding this, you know, sort of other languages are better at doing what they do, is where's the software that proves it? Where's the client-side software written in C-sharp that is demonstrably better than Objective-C software? Because I believe that you could point, before Objective-C was a thing on a Mac, you could point to incredibly good software written by tiny teams, comparatively, that was just demonstrably better than what was happening on other platforms. Just so that the readers don't throw something at me, let's take OmniWeb as an example. Small team made a web browser. Compare that against, you know, Netscape and all that, and it's like night and day difference.
Right.
Where do we see examples of that? Like, where you can't, maybe it's me, but I don't know. Like, I haven't seen counterexamples.
It's a fair question. The only example I can think of off the top of my head, which I actually haven't even used, is paint.net, which is kind of what is it? Gus Mueller that did a what's the crap? Oh, I'm such a terrible person. What's the really good non-Photoshop picture editor on the Mac?
Acorn?
Acorn, right?
Yeah. That's just about to say Pixelmator just to,
just to mess with them.
Just to get Gus to hate me.
Yeah,
it's Acorn, and it's really good. And you
right?
should,
Yeah, and that's Gus. Okay, so I'm not crazy. Well, anyway, so paint.net is, I believe, just a handful of people, and I'm talking outside my wheelhouse now, but from everything I gather, it's basically the Acorn for Windows. And it is written in .NET, and from everything I've heard, it's extremely good. But to your point, that's just
you know
about
what I'm looking at the website right now, and this is like Mac-like website. In that, it's like small, very concise, clear. What's not Mac-like is that they've got like four products, and they're all I already can't tell which one I want.
So that's the only example I can think of. But in general, I think the problem you collective viewer is going to run into is that how many good apps are there for Windows at all? Whether regardless of programming language, I would argue there's not really that many, or at least not when you take a design eye that a Macintosh user has grown to have. There are just not that many great apps. And so regardless of the programming language, you're not going to find a lot on Windows anyway.
Yeah, but I think there's a chicken and egg thing here, right? Where can't you argue that the environment and the ability to make good stuff means that the talent goes there to make good stuff? I mean, so like, why do you write Objective-C or work on the iPhone? Because you I don't want to give you an answer. You know, how about you give me the answer to the question I just posed you?
So the reason I do it is a couple of reasons. You know, firstly, I wanted to learn it. Secondly, I'm amused by it and intrigued by it. And I'm intrigued by the fact that everything I use on the iPhone is so unbelievably great, unbelievably well-designed, and just good. And I want to force myself to be better about those sorts of, to learn it and then get better about designy sort of things. And I feel like I don't have a lot of inspiration of good design, to your point, in Windows. Mm-hmm. And it's doubly hard because my day-to-day job isn't doing fun applications. It's doing consulting work, which I mean is fun, but a very different kind of fun. And so I don't see that inspiration in Windows, but I do see it on the Mac and on iOS. And so it's a combination of wanting to learn something new and wanting to get better at the things that I don't think I can get better at in my day-to-day job, which kind of, you know, proves your point.
Well, I don't know if it proves anything, but it, like I said, it's a chicken and egg thing. It's like, I what software's better on Apple platforms because it's better on Apple platforms. Like it's kind of a, like that's just doesn't
culture thing.
Tautology, it doesn't really prove anything, you know, but I'm curious to know why that is. Like certainly I came to the platform, but I came like I said, what was it like 85 years ago? And it's been a long time. And I came literally because John Carmack was like a Next fan. And I liked writing video games, so I checked out the Mac or I checked out OpenStep at the time. And, you know, I would compare it to the Windows registry and I would see the .plist files, which are effectively JSON. And I was like, this is just, it makes more sense.
Yep.
So, I followed what I liked. But I'm curious why that doesn't exist on other platforms. Why is it that Apple ignited sort of the app? Oh God, I'm going to sound like a douchebag, but why did Apple ignite the app revolution?
Isn't that a cultural thing though, to go back to your earlier point?
I think so. But I mean, what I'm loving about talking with Casey is that he's got an alternative perspective, right? Like a
different culture.
Right. No, really. It's great. Yeah, it's not like, close enough that we can kid each other and have fun and we're talking the same language.
Right.
Zing. But, you know, like it's you're coming at it from a different angle and a different time.
Yeah, and I think the canonical example of unbelievably great Windows apps are actually games. And the problem with that is I sincerely doubt any of them were written in C#. And so that's the tough thing. Is the only place that I think Windows really cares about really, really great apps is games. And yeah, there's a subset of Windows users that actually do give a crap, but the overwhelming majority don't care. Mm. And it's hard to be the lone standout. You know, it's hard to be the paint.net, the acorn, if you will, yeah, in a sea of SharePoint and Windows Paint and things of that nature. You know, it's just, it's hard to stand out. And wouldn't you want to be around something? You know, if you have a beautiful house, do you want to be in the neighborhood of beautiful houses, or do you want to be in the neighborhood of shit houses and you have the only good one? You know, common wisdom says you want to be in a neighbor, you want to be the small guy in a big neighborhood if you can. And it's a similar thing, but it doesn't really negate your point that for such a wildly wonderful language, or, you know, for such a robust and excellent language, why isn't there more great output from it? And I wish I could point to Windows Phone and say, well, that's where all the great output is. Yeah. But
me too. I would love to.
But, yeah, I mean that genuinely. I mean, it would be awesome. But unfortunately, from everything I can tell, it's not there either. And I don't have a good answer. I think other than a different culture, like, you know, like Renee was saying, it's just, for whatever reason, nobody's there. And all the really, really good developers, I think pretty much every really great developer that I've ever met that does C# is some form of consultant, either an independent one or someone like me that works for a consulting firm. Yeah. And that's just where the money is.
Yeah. But, you know, that said, that is precisely true of Objective-C developers before Apple bought Next.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Like that, if you were writing Objective-C code, you were doing it for on contract for basically big companies.
Right.
Okay, so we didn't resolve anything. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, you got to come back.
I'd be happy to.
We don't even know your current career, Tracy. You stopped at the fighter plane business.
Yeah, I stopped.
We got sidetracked. Suffice to say, it's all been web-based consulting after that. There's really not much to it.
Yeah, like you don't talk about it, so I kind of wasn't going to ask. Do you want to talk about what you're doing? You never bring it up, so I figure it's like not that what you want to talk about.
It's just, it's not that exciting. I mean, I write websites, oftentimes I oftentimes do CMS related stuff, content management system related stuff for companies. And it's been web-based consulting for the last almost 6 years now. And so oftentimes it's on the surface very boring, and certainly not anything that's very entertaining on a podcast. You know, it's writing somebody's corporate intranet, and it's oftentimes doing that on top of something like SharePoint, and SharePoint is evil from its core to the very outer fringes of it. And so
if we had short titles, by the way, this one would be Casey Liss, on the surface very boring.
Which is probably true. But I mean, it's not that I'm trying to dodge the question.
No.
There's really not much to it. The exciting ones were early in my career. The lucrative ones were later in my career. And
so here's a question, getting back to actually asking you stuff that's interesting. Which is my fault. Is C# better at the back end? Maybe I don't see software written in other languages as being great because I'm looking at client side stuff, where maybe it's back end that I just, it's like a total, you know, it's like the dark matter of the universe as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, you make a very interesting point. I wish I'd come up with that myself. I've been dabbling with Node a lot lately, and it's only been in the last month or two, but I've been doing a fair bit of work on it, and I've found that Node is extremely, extremely good for very, very, very quick stuff, and especially for RESTful APIs. Mm-hmm. So if I have either a database or some other data store, and I want a RESTful HTTP API for that data store, Node is excellent for that. But I've concluded recently, based on just thinking about the kinds of problems that I've turned to Node to solve, I've been thinking that, you know what, if I had something big, like, for example, an e-commerce site, just to invent something, you know, if I had an Amazon, if you will, or your Facebook or social network, I don't think I would want Node to be my backend. I would want something that has really good object-oriented statically typed, safe. I would want a safe language like C sharp. And the problem with C sharp is in most incarnations, you have to pay, you know, for a Windows license, you have to pay for I guess IIS comes with Windows or certain flavors of Windows, but there's a tangible cost involved with that. Unlike a Ruby or a PHP or something like, or Python, where you can get all that crap for free. And so there's a penalty there, but it is extremely good at those sorts of problems. But to be fair, I haven't really worked with Python enough. Like I know enough Python to get by, but I've never really worked with object-oriented Python. I know enough PHP to get by, but I've never really worked with object-oriented PHP. Mm-hmm. So I can't sit here and say it's definitely, you know, C-sharp is definitely better on the back end than either of those, but I can tell you it is very, very good and pretty quick.
By the way, it's funny that both of those languages have like object-oriented tacked on.
Yeah.
It's like, what, you didn't start with that? You started, it's like, that's kind of weird.
Is that obvious, right?
Yeah.
I hear you.
So yeah, maybe I'm looking at the wrong places for where the great software is.
Yeah, and that's probably true. And I wouldn't say the internet runs on IIS and C sharp, but a lot of it does. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it does. A lot more than I think even I realize.
A lot of the intranet does.
Oh, certainly. Oh,
that makes a lot of sense, too. Yeah.
But to be honest, I would count that as a detriment, given that SharePoint is such a piece of shit.
I lived with it for years, Casey. Your ire is
Imagine developing on top of it. It gets so much worse.
Cool. So that's who the hell Casey Luce is.
That's who that guy is.
Yeah. Thank you so much, man. It's been great. No, I don't want to keep any longer.
And I'm extremely flattered. Genuinely, I'm extremely flattered to be asked to be on the show, because I looked at the guest list and I was like, holy shit, I'm way out of my league right now.
That's perfect.
So eloquent, Casey.
Something like that. But I know I really appreciate you guys having me on. This is very kind of you too.
Well, I think we've had all three of you goofballs, but you're the only guy that actually deserved his own show.
You know, who am I to argue?
Right.
especially with an elder, right?
Where can we find you on the net, Casey?
You can find me. You can find me at Casey Liss on Twitter. That's CaseyLiss. And you can find my podcast with friends, Marco Arment and John Syracusa, at ATP.FM.
You know what we're going to do? We're just going to steal your outro song.
That's fine.
We're going to play it right now.
That's fine with me.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at ATP.FM. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CaseyL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MarcoArment, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse, it's accidental.